Packet Pushers.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Packet Protector, where we explore everything at the intersection of networking and security. I'm Jennifer Manella, aka JJ, here with Drew Connery Murray, aka The Drew, and today we're tackling quantum computing with our guest. We're going to be talking to Avesta Hojati. He's the VP of Engineering at DigiCert and a really awesome resource in this space. Drew and I are also gearing up for the RSA conference, May 6th to the 10th in San Francisco. So if you're going to be there, say hi. And remember, as always, you can hit us up at packetpushers.net/FU and reach out with any thoughts, ideas, feedback. But first, a few news headlines. So Drew, we have quite a few juicy tidbits this week in the news, and this isn't even really the tip of the iceberg. So the first thing is obviously Palo Alto has been this week's vulnerability du jour, but there's also a few Cisco vulnerabilities coming right behind it. So let's talk about Palo Alto first, because some of the things that have changed here, this of course was released at the end of last week. So it's going to be around April 12th-ish. Long story short, this is a CVSS of 10. So that's obvious, the highest we can go. I always say that's very rare, except for the first quarter here. I think all of them have been tens. But the challenge here is it is remote execution vulnerability. So this is being actively exploited in the wild. It's being tracked. People are able to come in using this vulnerability. It's actually two different CVEs. They're able to get into the Palo Alto firewall, pivot inside the network into Active Directory, and there they're able to scrape a lot of information, including credentials, keys. They can decrypt data, and of course, they can exfil data at that point. So huge issue. What's changed here is the first guidance that came out said that you could mitigate this by removing or disabling the telemetry going into the different portals and systems that are monitoring it. That is not the case. There are two things you can do. There are hot fixes. Several different versions that are impacted have also grown over the past few days. Just so your information's not stale, I'll let you go look that up. We've got links in the show notes for you. So you could upgrade to one of the hot fixes with the patches, and or if you get their threat intel service, there is a specific threat ID you can set it to protect against, and that will block the attack.
Yeah, just for clarity, we're recording on Thursday the 18th, if that helps with whatever timeline you're operating from as a listener. And this is a vulnerability in Palo Alto Networks PAN-OS, which is the operating system that runs its next-gen firewall.
Yep. So if you're researching this, I'm hoping at this point, by the time you're hearing this, you've already addressed it, but follow the CVE number 2024. 2024 for the year 3400, and be on the lookout for a second CVE being released related to this as well.
Yeah, and links in the show notes. Palo Alto Networks is not alone in announcing a vulnerability. Cisco has also announced a significant vulnerability. This one affects its integrated management controller, or IMC. This is a baseboard management controller for its UCS servers. The vulnerability could allow an attacker using a crafted CLI command to escalate privileges to root. Cisco has released a patch. There are no other workarounds to mitigate this vulnerability. Unlike the Palo Alto vulnerability, though, you do have to have local access to the device.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with the Cisco ecosystem. I'm sure some of our cohorts and fellow podcast hosts here in the Packet Pushers Network do. But one of the pieces of information I see in the affected products is it lists like three or four products there. But then it also says there are other Cisco appliances that are pre-configured with a version of this. And that list is quite long. It's like 30 or 40 different products ranging from wireless controllers to DNA center, everything related to looks like data center and cloud and management, down to secure email gateways and different malware protection and Prime. So this is definitely something to put on the radar and go check out.
Yeah. And again, links in the show notes. And sticking with Cisco, another security issue, the company announced that phone numbers and other customer data have been stolen from users of Cisco's Duo identity authentication product. Duo itself wasn't exploited, but an attacker was able to infiltrate a telephony provider that Duo uses to send those multi-factor authentication messages to clients.
Yeah, this is a weird one. And so nothing has happened with this yet, but I think this is another one of those stay tuned, because it sounds innocuous at first. You're probably looking at this thinking, well, okay, so they got random SMS messages with codes, no other information, but by scraping and knowing that they were Duo users, they know a lot of information about that phone, the user, the location, the service provider that it's on. It definitely makes a ripe environment for other targeted phishing attacks against those users. So I think in the coming weeks, we'll probably be circling back, you know, while we're at RSA, Drew, I'm sure this will be bubbling up, and maybe by then we'll have some actual exploits and attempts to talk about.
Yeah, in an email, the customer, Cisco, said the attacker couldn't get the actual messages that were sent, but they were able to download message logs for the entire month of March, and information they were able to get included the phone number, phone carrier, country, and state to which the message was sent, as well as other metadata like date and time of the message, type of message, and so on. And I guess the attacker who infiltrated the telephony provider used a phishing attack to get into the telephony provider, so they know that this attacker is good with the phishing attacks.
And the phishing attacks, just as an FYI, are getting a little bit more sophisticated. Maybe on another show, we'll talk about them, the LastPass stuff, but they're getting crafty, and they would fool, I think, even the most alert and aware security and IT professionals. So definitely something to be on the lookout for.
All right, our last news story before we pivot to our post-quantum cryptography conversation is probably a good one to end on. This is about the PuTTY client, the website Bleepy Computers reporting there's a vulnerability in the PuTTY utility that could potentially allow attackers to recover the private key used to generate signatures, but the attacker would have to have access to at least 60 cryptographic signatures to get to that private key.
Yeah, I mean, PuTTY is like our bread and butter is engineering, right? I don't do software development, but I know developers use it for a lot of their work commits. So this is a little bit bigger deal probably for that second use case of not on-prem engineering and networking people logging into hardware, but those different developers and programmers that are doing stuff that's publicly available, because getting your hands on then 50 or 60 pieces of information that are signed with these signatures is not a big deal because it's all out there in the internet for everybody to scrape. So this is one of those cases where, because the flaw or the vulnerability is in the key in the signing, it's not good enough to just update PuTTY. The affected versions are 0.68 through 0.80. So you need to get up to like 8.1, but you also need to regenerate and replace the private keys that were generated with the vulnerable version of PuTTY. And let me also mention too, you know, PuTTY is the back end SSH tool for a lot of other applications. So if you use FileZilla, WinSCP, TortoiseGit, TortoiseVPN, et cetera, that list goes on. Basically, if you SSH into anything, go check your stuff and see if it's using PuTTY on the back end. And if so, you need to update it and then redo the keying material.
All right. Well, I guess this is a good time then to bring in our guest, Dr. Avesta Hojati, to talk about post-quantum cryptography. This is, I think, a fascinating subject. Avesta, welcome. And let's just get started. Let's dive right in. What is post-quantum cryptography?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Drew. Generally speaking, for the past 40 to 50 years, we have been relying our cryptographic solutions based on what we call classical encryption algorithms. You might be familiar with the term RSA, ECC. These are a type of asymmetric algorithms. And then AES, which is a symmetric encryption algorithm. Everything that we have built, these products that we have today based on these encryption algorithms, potentially could be broken given the advancement in quantum computing. For the past few years, we have all heard about quantum computers and how capable they are of solving certain problems. And some of those problems are very useful to be solved. For example, modern cancer cells in a much faster period of time. On the other hand, some of the problems that these quantum computers are good at solving are potentially going to break these classical encryption algorithms. Now, to your original question, what is post-quantum crypto? National Institute of Standards and Technology back in 2017 started a competition where basically researchers across the industry will come up with solutions that are capable of protecting our encryption algorithms against both classical as well as quantum computers. This is generally referred to as post-quantum crypto or quantum safe algorithms.
Before we get into the quantum resistant algorithms, what makes current algorithms susceptible to attack by quantum computers?
Yeah, the current algorithms are mostly based on what we call factorization problem. So let's take a very simple example of RSA. RSA is basically based on identifying two randomly generated large prime numbers, multiplying those large prime numbers to create a much larger prime number. Now, for existing computers today, it's very hard to figure out what are the roots of this single large prime number.
Okay.
This is very short, kind of describing the problem. That being said, for a quantum computer utilizing the basis of quantum mechanics, such as entanglement and superpositioning, solving this factorization problem is not going to take millions of years. It doesn't take years. Potentially could take seconds, minutes, or at maximum a few days. Now, this by itself is a very big problem because when the algorithm and cryptographer designers were thinking about designing RSA or ECC, they never thought that classical computers in a short period of time will be able to solve this factorization problem. We often have heard that Our encryption algorithms are so good that it will take millions of years for existing computers, even if you have supercomputers, to solve them. In the world of quantum computers, that is not the case. They basically have a different approach and different capability to be able to solve this factorization problem.
Talk to me like I'm five. What is a quantum computer? What class of machine fits into this?
So the computers that we're dealing with today, such as your laptop, your cell phones, basically whatever that has a processor runs off of bits. These are either being zeros and ones. And at any given time, those are the only value that they're capable of producing, either zero or one. Now, following Moore's law, these computers have gotten much faster every 14 to 18 months. The number of transistors has doubled and so forth.
Except for my laptops, which seem to work for about 3 weeks and then they just explode and can't do anything.
So some folks are still keeping their certain number of transistors and they don't want to upgrade. But generally, the industry has doubled the number of transistors, and that by itself means more computation could happen on these classical computers. Now, those computations, to a sense, are limited in what we are capable of doing. Doing a graphic design, doing hard computations, and so forth. And that is great that they're getting more powerful. But there is this newer generation of computers that we call quantum computers, where they're running off of what is known as qubits. Qubits are generally running off of the phenomena of quantum mechanics. And I mentioned two terminologies, both entanglement and superpositioning. And those abilities in qubits, in what we call a stable and powerful enough quantum computer, and those terms are very important, are capable of solving problems in a completely different dimension that we previously have seen in comparison to classical computers. I mentioned modeling cancer cells. Quantum computers are very good at doing this because computationally they have more resources available to them for solving this modeling problems. Whereas in the classical computers, no matter how horizontally you're able to scale them, they still aren't able to solve certain set of problems in a faster period of time.
I want to ask about this too. So you mentioned RSA algorithm. You mentioned ECC, elliptic curve crypto. And I know from the networking side, you know, we know RSA was a little more computationally intense. ECC was meant to be stronger, but also lighter in terms of the resource load and therefore appropriate for like IoT and small form factor devices. Where does the post-quantum crypto fit in that scale? Is it even lighter? I'm air quoting lighter than ECC in terms of overhead?
There's a generally public belief that post-quantum crypto algorithms are slower than your classical algorithms, such as RSA or ECC that you mentioned. That is actually not true. Performance-wise, the post-quantum crypto algorithms are often much better than your classical algorithm. What holds true is that the signature size and the key size for these post-quantum crypto algorithms is significantly larger than your RSA or ECC. And that by itself, of course, causes a pretty big problem. You mentioned embedded devices or IoT devices. We already have seen the complexity for putting large keys inside embedded devices utilizing classical algorithms. Now imagine, in order for you to make that device to be protected against quantum computers, you have to put a key size in there that is probably 5 to 10 times bigger. So performance is not a problem, but the complexity of putting these large key sizes for post-quantum crypto in either being devices, potentially load balancers or web servers, will become a headache pretty soon.
I guess that raises another question then. Can I run this post-quantum cryptography on a classical computer, or are they only for quantum computers?
No. So running post-quantum crypto algorithms doesn't require to having access to a quantum computer. You're capable of pushing these post-quantum crypto algorithms into your existing solutions based on classical computers. That being said, there are still changes that has to take place. For example, protocols have to be upgraded and updated in order for them to understand the post-quantum crypto algorithms. Mm-hmm. Applications also need to understand what these post-quantum crypto algorithms are. And even taking a step further, beginning from the operating systems should also understand what really this new set of new algorithms that they're going to deal with are going to be. But from a hardware perspective, you don't need to have a quantum computer to push post-quantum crypto.
So the updates for our classical computers processing this, then is this a hardware update? Is it a software? Is it it depends? Because, I mean, looking back over the networking life, we've seen TKIP used for a long time instead of AES because we had hardware that just couldn't do AES at the time. What is the stepping stone for us with our traditional compute systems right now?
There are a set of hardwares that aren't just capable of supporting these post-quantum crypto algorithms. And the biggest driver for those are the lack of memory that they have available in order for them to be able to hold these secret keys, much larger secret keys compared to classical algorithms. On the other hand, you also will have legacy devices that computationally, to the example that you mentioned, wouldn't be able to handle these amount of larger signatures within their hardware capability. So the process that we are seeing is that from a software perspective, if we are trying to stay secure, we will go through what I call not a migration, but an elevation in security, where we are elevating the upgrades to us post-quantum crypto. And for the newer devices that we are developing, this could be IoT devices, this could be embedded devices, we have to think about the concept of security by design, where these post-quantum crypto algorithms are being pushed on the hardware that they have the capability of supporting them.
You mentioned NIST. It sounds like they've already started addressing this problem. Are there quantum-resistant algorithms being proposed or that are available? What's the state of the art right now?
So the process from NIST started back in 2017. This is basically a competition that NIST opened to the entire world. Anyone across the globe could go ahead and be part of this process. A lot of different submissions took place, and fast forwarding 7 years from now, and after multiple different rounds that NIST has gone through, that has reviewed these submissions, have merged few and have dropped few, either due to lack of performance, potentially vulnerabilities, where we are standing today is that we have three signatures that NIST is going to finalize to be a standardized, potentially before end of the year. Those are namely your Dilithium, Sphinx Plus, and Falcon. The first two have gone through their public comment, which is a 90-day period from NIST, where anybody could review them, provide their comments on them. The expectation is that before end of the year, the final spec for these two algorithms will be released. And the third one is Falcon, which has been finalized, but has not gone through the public comment. There's also another category, which is key encapsulation mechanisms. This one, the name for it is Crystal Kyber. And this is where you probably have heard mostly from Google, Cloudflare, and large enterprises where they began pushing these key encapsulation mechanisms for PQC in their product. Matter of fact, on April 16th, the release that Google Chrome had by default supports this PQC key encapsulation mechanism.
Just a brief pause to ask, did you know Packet Pushers has a job board? Whether you're looking to find or fill your next great IT infrastructure role, the Packet Pushers job board is the place to go. It's easy to post, easy to browse, and easy to apply. So whether you've got IT talent or you're looking for IT talent, visit jobs.packetpushers.net and get to work. That's jobs.packetpushers.net.
Lots of acronyms in the name, so we will put these in the show notes for everybody.
Yes, I just wanted to go through the names one more time. Dilithium, Falcon, and Sphinx Plus. Those are going through the approval process with NIST, yes?
Yes, and those three are signatures.
Signatures, okay. And then you mentioned Kyber, which I guess is getting some backing from Google, but also going through the NIST process.
Well, the Kyber has gone through the NIST process, but is not a signature. Kyber is a key encapsulation mechanism, or for short, we call it KEM. KEM is basically enabling you to go through a key exchange mechanism between the server and client. And in the case of Kyber, this is the post-quantum crypto secured. Google has already deployed this on their browsers. Cloudflare has begun enforcing this on their server side. Matter of fact, 2% of their traffic already is on this PQC-supported KEM mechanism.
So what is KEM used for then? Is this like digital signatures with the public and private key exchange, or is it for protecting symmetric keys that you want to send over the internet?
Yeah, so as the name describes, key encapsulation basically enables you to put the keys inside a capsule in a sense, and then allows you to go ahead and exchange these keys. This by itself is very important because the way that we are communicating on the internet today and why PKI is very important is initiating every connection via a public and private key. This is often referred to as asymmetric connection. Once the asymmetric has been established, we know that we have a secure channel, which we will move to symmetric connections, meaning the same private key. Why we do this? Well, performance, because symmetric keys are performing much better than asymmetric keys. Now, in the case of key encapsulation mechanism, we need to have a mechanism that enables us to exchange these keys, but also considering the threat of quantum computers, we want to do this in a post-quantum matter. So what key encapsulation mechanism does in case is putting these keys inside a capsule, utilizing post-quantum crypto methods in order to make sure that the key exchange session is secure.
So would this be like a post-quantum crypto version of an anonymous Diffie-Hellman exchange for establishing that relationship?
You describe it pretty well.
1 point for me, Drew.
Well done, JJ. I guess my understanding then is the issue with classical algorithms is that the factor of two very large primes, it's easy for a quantum computer to figure out what the two original primes were. Can you explain to non-mathematicians what the new mechanisms are that are being used to that would thwart the computational power of a quantum computer?
If you look at the three algorithms that we described that NIST has gone through the approval process, either being your Dilithium, Falcon, or Sphinx Plus, these are all based on different type of mathematical families. You probably have heard of the hash-based math. You have heard about lattice-based, supersingular isogeny. These are different families of mathematics that these algorithms have been built on, where generally is believed, at least till now, that a quantum computer doesn't have the capability of solving these problems easily. Now, considering that I said generally we have believed that so far these are hard because this could change, and we have seen even without the existence of a powerful and stable enough quantum computers, some of these families of mathematics and some of the implementation based on these families could be vulnerable. For example, a few days ago, a research paper came out that hasn't gone under the peer review yet and is still in the process. But it claims that a specific category, this is known as LWE, or learning with errors, could potentially create specific vulnerabilities within any lattice-based algorithm that has gone through the NIST process.
So that would affect the quantum-resistant algorithms we just discussed because they are lattice-based, except for one which is hash-based?
That is correct. So if you have a lattice-based algorithm, again, granted, this is a specific research that is still going through peer review, it has very specific settings for this to hold true, could still potentially make some of these lattice-based algorithms to be vulnerable.
I imagine somebody might hear this and go, oh, well then, if somebody advertises their proprietary post-quantum crypto algorithms, that's going to be better and more secure than the stuff coming out of NIST. But I assume, just like with the rest of crypto world, that's not the case, and we want to steer people towards incorporating these protocols that have been fully vetted by the whole industry instead of one person or organization.
Yeah, I want to take a different angle to that, JJ. For some of your audience, they probably remember the migration from SHA-1 to SHA-256, or we call it SHA-2. That was an open algorithm. Everybody looked at it. They all approved it. But all of a sudden, we figured out that there is a collision. So either having a closed algorithm or open source that has gone through multiple different rounds of reviews, I don't think the right solution is going to an enterprise with a completely closed box of algorithm versus the one that has gone through review. The right solution here is to be agile. And I think this is a good segue to bring this terminology that we call crypto agility. This is where, irrelevant of what algorithm you use, you want to make sure that you have a framework and process in place at any moment, at any given time, automatically you can move from one algorithm, which potentially could be broken, to an algorithm which is safe and secure. And you can keep doing this over and over again. Instead of locking in one algorithm, you have a process that enables you to access as many safe algorithms as possible.
I think we would all love that idea, but let me kind of ask the vision for this, because obviously when you're talking about crypto, you've got two parties involved. And so I know one of the challenges we've had over the years is it's sometimes easy to upgrade one side of that, but the other thing, whatever the thing is, endpoint, browser, some other application, some other piece of hardware, doesn't have that capability yet. And, you know, obviously refresh cycles for things change. So if it's a software update, that's easier, but I would say even there's a lot of stuff floating around that doesn't get the software updates it should have. Is there a different strategy from just 101 level, like asset and inventory management, that goes along with this?
Absolutely. Yes. So there are three different buckets that we generally define crypto agility in. Number one is either being considered discovery, if you already have an environment that has the components deployed, or it will be development with security design. The latter usually is applicable when it comes to devices. Point of sales, this could be a satellite that goes to the outer orbit that you want to make sure that you do have that over-the-air update and remote connection to it. But let's focus on discovery for a second. And the concept that they describe as far as crypto agility is not going to be 100% successful unless you have a visibility and you have an asset management of all of your cryptographic libraries. Most audience are familiar with SBOM, Software Bill of Material, but they're probably not familiar with CBOM, which is Crypto Bill of Material. There is not a single enterprise out there that could potentially answer the following question, which is, show me all of your cryptographic libraries across all of your organization, or can answer if they have an MD5 or a SHA-1 or any other algorithm environment. So the discovery portion of this becomes very important because you cannot automate what you cannot discover and you cannot manage what you can discover. Now, the second bucket will be the automation portion. Once I have created that discovery, once I have that asset management across my entire organization, I should be able to automate those endpoints, either being my load balancers, web servers, some of the clients, such as the web browsers, if I have MDM and so forth. And the marriage between discovery and automation will enable me to go to The third bucket, which is management. I already know where my assets are. I already have automated the process of replacing those cryptographic libraries. And now the third bucket of management will enable me to create policies and automatic deployments to figure out these outdated crypto libraries or the broken ones and automatically replace them.
But how much of this is going to be, say, in an enterprise IT's hands? Because like my firewall vendor, my load balancing vendor, my VPN vendor, they're the ones who are going to be onboarding all the certificates and encryption algorithms that that device is going to need to operate. That's not up to me.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. So you mentioned firewalls, for example, or load balancers. In the case of load balancers, there are multiple different solutions out there that are capable of integrating to load balancers, where they're able to actually automatically install, revoke, and remove certificates on those load balancers. Now, your point is valid when you're dealing with a device manufacturer, where as a consumer, I really want to interact with a secure device. And that's where that over-the-air update comes into play. We are all dealing with autonomous vehicles now with capabilities such as over-the-air update. And if the manufacturer has potentially designed this vehicle properly, they should be able to push in new cryptographic algorithms over there, make sure that that function works in that autonomous vehicle, and is basically not disabling that device.
And maybe if that happens, then seven of them won't pile up together on an interstate and block an exit ramp.
That is true. I think one big problem of that is that we are not considering different devices and their different capabilities and the chain of command that basically could break these systems.
Yeah, because a lot of times in an org, I mean, more often than not, unless there's a one-man band or one-woman band somewhere, you know, there's a team that handles this part of the infrastructure, right? There's a team that handles the WAFs. There's a team that handles the firewalls. There's a team that handles these endpoints. So let me roll back a little bit to that discovery part where you're talking about the CBOM, that crypto bill of materials, because I think that's a fantastic idea. Are there tools to help people do this discovery? Because again, I feel like we don't even have a handle on just standard inventory asset of hardware and software. What kind of tools are out there?
There are multiple different tools available. The one that I'm familiar with from a team that I work with closely here at DigiCert is Trust Lifecycle Manager. It's a tool that enables you to discover all of your cryptographic assets, either being on load balancers, web servers, endpoints such as desktops, laptops, whatever that might be, and bringing all of those under one dashboard. Granted, to the beginning of the point that you made, JJ, it's important to have these tools, but it's also important how and where we are deploying them. If you're dealing with an organization with 15,000 employees, multiple different IT teams, there is always a chance that you're forgetting about an angle because you haven't deployed a sensor or this solution, what we call as deep and as wide across your organization. So there are multiple different solutions out there that enable you to do either internal or external discovery of your cryptographic asset. And at the end of the day, what this comes down to is to be able to aggregate all of this data under one umbrella, but also being able to make sense of the data that has been collected.
Just kind of broadly speaking in ecosystem, are these tools appropriate for use, you know, in cloud assets as well, like infrastructure in the cloud as well as on-prem? And are there some options that might do like endpoint agent, I'm air quoting again, kind of scanning versus things you could drop on the network and watch, you know, traffic operationally? What do those things look like?
Yeah, definitely. There are different ways to be able to utilize some of these services. So on the on-prem scenario, similarly, you can go ahead and deploy your agent that communicate with your SaaS application. And the agent basically either could do port scanning, look at your load balancers, integrate to your Apache or IIS web servers, or even do a deep scan on those web servers and extract the crypto libraries and then report back to that SaaS application. On the cloud is also very similar. You can go ahead and deploy these sensors or agents, depending on the use case, and gather all of this data. Now, I think the terminology of agent or sensor often is being considered as applying either a man-in-the-middle attack to terminate a connection in order for you to be able to find out where these libraries are. And that is not true. In the case of discovery, there's no need for terminating a connection. There's no need for reading plain text data. All is happening is basically looking for a specific set of cryptographic libraries or looking for X509 certificates across the organization, on the cloud, on-prem, on their data centers, and then gathering all of this data, sorting them, and applying the proper tags to them.
So speaking of like kind of this discovery and inspection, but different from that, you know, we do in the networking world have a lot of technologies we use that do inspection that is, whether it's considered a man in the middle or an on-path attack, or you're distributing, you know, keys around, will that type of inspection and visibility persist? Will we have mechanisms with post-quantum crypto to do that moving forward?
For example, your DPIs, your deep packet inspection. For solutions that are doing DPI and wants to deploy the post-quantum crypto algorithms, you definitely want to make sure that your DPI also understands how to observe and how to digest the PQC keys, right? Because the simplest form for a DPI is providing the private key. Now you can go ahead and decrypt the traffic and look into the data. For those solutions, you really want to make sure that they do understand these algorithms and the keys. Now, for the discovery part, there are integrations that has taken place between discovery solutions and DPI solutions in order to make sure that they have better visibility. But generally, this is not required because you're not looking for private key for the sense of reading data. You're looking for cryptographic algorithms and libraries that have generated these private keys. And as a derivative of this, you'll be able to basically flag if your private key is an insecure private key because it has utilized a broken algorithm, or is a secure one in the case of PQC, and they could be protected for a while.
I'm curious if the use of quantum resistant algorithms is going to affect sort of the current framework for how we do things with cryptography, for how we encrypt traffic, how we sign certificates and so on. I mean, like, are we going to have to find new ways to do things like sign certificates or exchange keys, or does the quantum resistant cryptography just sort of slot into existing frameworks?
No, and this is a very big center of argument right now. As you know, and many of your audience probably know, internet is not like a switch that it can turn it on and off, meaning that it will take a while to move from one solution to the other one. But specifically when it comes to PQC, this becomes very complex and obviously very important. I'll give you an example. We know at some point RSA and ECC will be broken. We don't know when, because we don't have access to that large or stable enough quantum computer today, but potentially we will get there at some point. And we also have the solutions from Nest being the post-quantum crypto algorithms that are going to be finalized before end of the year. Now, there are multiple different ways to do this. Either as vendors and as clients, we could go ahead and say, we are not going to accept RSA algorithms starting January 1st, 2025, which will be catastrophic. We saw that with SHA-1 to SHA-2. Again, you cannot turn one algorithm off and turn the other one on because right. The legacy systems wouldn't communicate.
Right.
Or the other approach is what we generally call a hybrid approach. And in the sense of hybrid approach, we are going to support classical algorithms for a period of time and start pushing out the post-quantum crypto algorithms immediately. For the newer clients, if they're going to initiate the post-quantum crypto algorithms via their server client connections, then great, they will be moved to PQC. And for the legacy ones, they still will rely on RSA. This period and the different solutions that they exist that we generally call hybrid, because there is at least three different categories of hybrid approach, is most likely going to be what we are going to see after the final specs for post-quantum algorithms will be released from Nest.
You said immediately. I mean, I think I'm sitting here and Drew's sitting here thinking like, this is a future thing, but you said immediately. So immediately, like now, people should be doing and thinking about this now and working towards that sort of transition mode. Where does this fall on the list of priorities of now? Is this like immediately, if not sooner? Is this like now-ish when you can get to it? Is it like 18 months from now?
Yeah, it really depends how you're prioritizing security. The argument that I often hear is that we don't have access to that quantum computer, meaning I can keep operating off of what I have today. Well, that is not really true. There's a category of attack that we call harvest now, decrypt later. And that basically means I'm able to harvest your encrypted data today. And once I have access to that quantum computer, either being a nation state or just accessing this powerful quantum computer, I'll be able to decrypt the data that I have collected. Now, the question becomes, what type of a data has so large of an importance that I want to make sure that it's secured against this quantum attack? Financial institutes, these are the number one category. For the past 6 months, I have interacted with over 100 of different banks and financial institutes where they're worried about the attack of quantum computers, because they understand that harvest now, decrypt later is happening right now. So they want to make sure that they're moving towards a solution that protects and against quantum computers right away. The other aspect of this is around healthcare, where they are worried about PII, personal identifying information. Consider a data of a patient that you're going to transmit from the time that they have been born until they pass away, and even potentially 20 years after that for the sake of research. So what you want to do, you want to make sure that you are able to encrypt this data utilizing a solution that keeps you secure for the next 50 years and not only for the next 5 years. So to urge your point, the recommendation is to categorize the use cases based on their priorities and begin migrating them to a post-quantum crypto algorithms right away instead of waiting for the RSA algorithm to be broken.
So just curious here, in the post-quantum world, even the things that we have now that have like perfect forward secrecy features in them, those will be broken by quantum computing.
That is correct. If you are utilizing asymmetric algorithms, the strength of that asymmetric algorithm, such as RSA or ECC, will be completely weakened to zero. Meaning, doesn't matter how big of a key size you have, 2048, 4096. Once we have a stable enough quantum computer that can run an algorithm by the name of Shor's algorithm, their strength will be zero. On the symmetric side, the approach is a little bit different. The strength of any symmetric algorithm will be weakened by half. So if you have an AES-256, it will be only as strong as AES-128. So you can go ahead and double the key size, but obviously that comes at a cost of performance.
I understand the notion that capture now, decrypt later is a potential risk, but my assumption is that as quantum computers emerge, the first entities that are going to have any kind of operational quantum computer are probably going to be nation states, and we're not even sure when that will be. So I guess this also sort of goes back to JJ's question, like, do I really have to worry about this now? It feels like kind of...
There's two ways to look at it, Drew. So the first one is, even if a nation state has access to a quantum computer that is capable of breaking RSA, do you think this nation state will announce that they actually have broken RSA? That will be very catastrophic, right? It will be chaos for the entire internet. At the beginning, you guys were talking about news about PuTTY, and I have heard probably a dozen times every hour that make sure your PuTTY is upgraded. Now consider that RSA, which we have embedded everywhere, is broken. So number one is that even if somebody has broken this, in my humble opinion, I wouldn't think that they will announce that. The second portion of this is, the amount of secrets that we are transmitting today has so much value to these nation states that without a doubt, there are falling processes to do harvest now, decrypt later, or when it comes to application, they can do verify now, forge later. Both of these are real threats that CISOs has began recognizing in the past 12 months. I'm being completely honest, prior to 2022, this wasn't on their radar. But they were waiting for the regulations to come out. They were waiting for NIST to go through the final approval. But in the past 12 months, vast majority of CISOs that I have interacted with, they are putting this on their radar for two reasons. Number one, they believe that regulations are coming down pretty soon, where they're going to have a requirement to deploy post-quantum crypto algorithms, either from the perspective of their auditors or from a compliance perspective. And number two, they realize that if a secret is going to get compromised, and this secret could be a trade secret, financial secret, whatever that might be, due to the lack of properly encrypting that data, this will be their fault for not thinking about future attacks and not being prepared to secure the infrastructure against these attacks.
And there's a whole other list in my head here, too, because, you know, it's not just nation states, but you've got ransomware. Let's take the malware part of the ransomware extortion out of it. But if they're able to capture that data and then extort based on it, right? So you're in the same position. You could have lawsuits from, you know, especially in the healthcare space for those patients saying you did not do a good enough job, you know, securing our private information. Obviously, there's implications in the financial market. But I mean, I think even in the rest of the world, I kind of thinking through a lot of scenarios where, yeah, if after X amount of time, whatever that is, if this is happening, and I do think that these, you know, systems will be available, right? They're going to be more generally available at some point. They're going to be in the hands of research units and not just in nation states. So yeah, I think this does make sense if we're saying we need to start, but I don't even know, like, where do we start other than just sitting and waiting for our vendors to shove it down our throat? How can we be proactive?
Yeah, I think JJ, the first line of defense here is visibility. Back to that crypto bill of material. And I encourage vast majority of individuals that I have talked to ask a simple question during their engineering meetings. Do we know where all of our cryptographic assets are? Do we know what version of OpenSSL are we using? Do we know what vulnerabilities we have? And if you cannot answer those questions, then the first call of action is to be able to get that visibility into your infrastructure. The second call of action is to obviously come up with a strategy that enables you to, after having this visibility, automating the process of managing these cryptographic libraries. Automation is the biggest aspect that we can handle here, right? I mean, if there's a manual process where I have to go ahead and manually upgrade my crypto libraries from OpenSSL version X to whatever other version that might be, then that by itself is a single point of failure, because I potentially could forget, I don't have visibility into it, and that by itself is going to cause a lot of problem for the organization. So looking at this from a 30,000 foot view, the first call of action for any enterprise is get the visibility, get the automation in place, make sure that you have an approach to crypto agility. And that the third portion of this is that deploying post-quantum crypto in order for you to elevate your security should come at no time. You already have the visibility, you already have the automation, and this is just a matter of policy for you to deploy.
Feels like IPv6 all over again, Drew. We just have to start demanding it in the products, at least.
But we haven't finished IPv6 yet. Can we do one at a time, please?
No, two dragons at once.
Well, Avesta, thank you very much. I feel like we've probably just scratched the surface on post-quantum cryptography, but this is a fascinating discussion and definitely something I think we're going to be revisiting. But thank you for your time for getting us started with this. We have some links in the show notes if you want to start reading up on what NIST is doing and things you should be thinking about. So thank you very much for being here. And thank you to the listeners for being with us for another episode of Packet Protector. You can find us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want more nerdy goodness on networking, wireless, cloud, network automation, and more, it's all at packetpushers.net, where you'll find thousands of hours of free technical content for your listening pleasure. And we've got a Slack group. You can talk to other IT and network engineers and security folks. And JJ and I are also on that Slack if you want to reach out and say hello or give us a show idea or give us some follow-up. We'd love to hear from you. It's all at packetpushers.net.